continue to sell and be featured through our virtual Indian market. Many of the components we are developing can be captured perpetually, and with some innovation, we could be completely sustainable as an organization. That is the goal. A hot ticket highlight of Indian Market is always the Haute Couture fashion show, and that will still be the case with this August's virtual Indian Market, when designer Orlando Duggi takes the stage with SWAIA's 2020 fashion film project. Duggi's exquisite new line will debut virtually with a short film Sunday, August 16th, during Market Weekend. Staged in an intimate fashion show setting, with a limited audience in attendance during the filming of the show and for the actual live screening of the fashion film, the short film presents Duggi's striking designs and provides a behind-the-scenes glimpse into his life and the crafting of his latest line. Special guests will be wearing their finest attire and observing proper social distancing practices. For virtual fashionistas, the online viewing of the film will be followed by a question and comment session with Duggi and the models.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Starting Wednesday on the Noon Book Hour, we continue our summer book series with The Last Trial by Scott Turow. At 85 years old, Alejandro Sandy Stern, a brilliant defense lawyer with his health failing but spirit intact, is on the brink of retirement. But when his old friend Dr. Karel Pafko, a former Nobel Prize winner, is faced with charges of insider trading, fraud, and murder, his entire life's work is put in jeopardy. And Stern decides to take on one last trial. In a case that will be the defining coda to both men's accomplished lives, Stern will question everything he thought he knew about his friend. Despite Pafko's many failings, is he innocent? Stern's duty to defend his client and his belief in the power of the judicial system both face a final terrible test in the courtroom, where the evidence and reality are sometimes worlds apart. The Last Trial, starting Wednesday at noon and repeated Thursday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 86 and clear. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
Hachette Audio presents The Last Trial, written by Scott Turow, read by John Bedford Lloyd. For all my grandchildren, those here, those to come. Prologue. A woman screams, shrill and desolate. The brief sound rips through the solemn hush in the corridors of the old federal courthouse. Within the huge courtroom of the chief judge, the spectators are on their feet. The case on trial here, the criminal prosecution of a world-renowned physician, has been national news, and the gallery has been shoulder to shoulder every day. Now most of the onlookers are straining to see what has just happened beyond the walnut rail that bounds the area reserved for the trial participants. The defendant's lead counsel, a very old man but still quite celebrated, has sagged from sight at the defense table. His client, the accused doctor, who is almost as aged as his attorney, kneels, holding the fallen man's limp hand by the wrist. "No pulse!" the doctor shouts. "Help, please!" With that, the young woman beside him, who first cried out, takes flight. She is the paralegal on the case and also the old lawyer's granddaughter, and she bulls down the center aisle of the gallery, headed toward the door. Beside the doctor, the attorney's daughter, his law partner for decades, has been largely paralyzed by distress. All along, she has approached this trial, their last case together, with foreboding. Now she is weeping spontaneously, making no sound despite the tears racing down behind her glasses. The two prosecutors, the United States attorney and his younger assistant, have sped from their seats across the courtroom. Working together, the pair take hold of the figure heaped on the floor. In her robe, the chief judge has rushed down from the bench, intent on taking control of the scene, but she stops, suddenly mindful that the jury remains here. Like the other onlookers, the jurors are on their feet in the box in various stricken poses. The judge points to the deputy marshal positioned near them and shouts, "Remove the jury, please," then continues forward. The court security officer, in his blazer and flesh-colored earpiece, has run across the courtroom to help, and with his aid, the prosecutors slowly hoist the old lawyer's body, placing him on his back on the walnut table, as his daughter shoves aside papers and equipment to make room. The old doctor quickly spreads the attorney's suit jacket and rips open his white shirt to expose his chest. The lawyer and the doctor have been friends for decades, and there is a trace of tenderness as the physician briefly presses his ear over the other man's heart, then sets the heel of his palm on the sternum of the inert figure, pumping with both hands at regular intervals. "Someone breathe for him," the doctor urges. The judge, who has known the lawyers on both sides for years, reacts first, pinching open the attorney's pale lips and setting her mouth on his as she exhales deeply. The sight seems to bring the daughter back to herself, and after the first dozen or so breaths, she takes over. The prosecutors and the security officer have stepped back. Perhaps they mean to give the doctor room, or perhaps, like everyone else here, they find the sight of the old lawyer motionless on the table like a Spartan on his shield, stark and horrifying. A small man, he has nonetheless always been a dominating presence in the courtroom. Now he lies here, sadly, exposed. Sparse white hairs curl across his breast, and his flesh has the grayish undertone of skim milk. The left side of his chest appears somewhat sunken, where the livid mark of a surgical scar follows from just below his nipple all the way to his back. Incongruously, his red, white, and blue necktie, still knotted in his collar, hangs down his naked side. The young woman who screamed and then fled has returned. She is an odd person. You can see that, not just because of the inch-long nail driven through her nose as decoration, but also from the slightly angry and indifferent way she deals with people. "Move! Move!" she shouts, dodging up the aisle. She carries a red plastic case in her right hand, where blood is welling from her knuckles. The latch on the box in the corridor that houses the defibrillator was jammed, and after several desperate tries, the lawyer's granddaughter simply punched in the thin glass. As she passes the front spectator's row, one of the long line of journalists standing there remarks to a colleague beside him, "Talk about going out with your boots on." Immediately after delivering the equipment to the doctor, the young woman wheels, pointing her bloody hand at the reporter. "That's shit, Stu," she says. "No way he's dying." Part 1. Opening. November 5th, 2019. 1. The End. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury," says Mr. Alejandro Stern. For nearly 60 years, he has offered this greeting to start his defense of the accused. And with the words today, a vapor of melancholy scuttles across his heart. But he is here. We live in the everlasting present, and he knows this much with iron certainty. He has had his turn. "This is the end," he says, "for me." Without lowering his eyes from the jury, he blindly probes his midsection to fasten the center button on his suit coat, as he always has done after his first few words. "No doubt you have been thinking, the defense lawyer is so very old." And you are correct, of course. Standing up to the government when the freedom of a good person, like Dr. Kirill Pavko, hangs in the balance, is not a task for someone of my age. This will be my final time. Behind him on the bench, Chief Judge Sonia Klonsky utters an unformed sound as if clearing her throat. Yet having known Sonny well for 30 years, he understands as clearly as if she had spoken. Were he to say more about his personal situation, the judge will politely cut him off. "Yet I could not refuse this case," he adds. "Mr. Stern," Judge Klonsky says, "perhaps you should turn to the proof." Looking up to her on the carved walnut bench, Stern lets his head droop in a small bow. It is a gesture retained from his boyhood in Argentina, which also left the whisper of an accent that embarrasses him, even now, whenever he hears recordings of his voice. "Just so, Your Honor," he answers, then turns again to the jury. "Marta and I are proud to stand beside Dr. Pavko at this crucial moment, in what has been a long and honored life. Marta, if you would." Marta Stern rises slowly at the defense table, greeting the jurors with a pleasant smile. As her father sees her, Marta is that unusual person who looks far better in her middle years than she did as a young woman. Fit, well-coiffed, and at ease. Stern, by contrast, has been withered by age and disease. But even now, he does not need to say she is his daughter. Both are short and thickly built. Both show the same awkward combination of wide features. Nodding, Marta resumes her seat at the defense table beside their paralegal, Pinky, Stern's granddaughter. Stern lifts his hand next to his client. Kira, please. Dr. Pafko, too, comes to his feet, stiffened by age but still tall and attentive to his appearance. A white silk pocket square bubbles above one line of the golden buttons on his double-breasted blazer. His silver hair, streaked by yellow and almost entirely thinned away on top, is swept back debonairly, while his teeth are uneven and small as he attempts a charming smile. How old a man are you, Kirill?
78,
Pafko answers at once. Stern's question to his client at a time when only the lawyers are supposed to speak is clearly improper. But Stern knows from long experience that the government's lead counsel, the United States Attorney, Moses Appleton, will bypass minor objections rather than have the jury think he is eager to hide things. Stern wants Kirill's voice to be among the jurors' first impressions, so they will be less disappointed if, as Stern hopes, Kirill never takes the stand in his own defense.
78,
Stern repeats, and tosses his head in mock amazement. A young man, he adds, and the 14 jurors, including the two alternates, all smile. Let me tell you a bit about what the evidence will show concerning Kirill Pafko. He came to the U.S. from Argentina to complete his medical education roughly half a century ago, accompanied by his wife, Donatella, who is there behind him in the first row. Donatella Pafko, a year or two older than Stern, 86 or 87 now, sits with a regal air, utterly composed, her white hair gathered into a smooth bun, her face heavily made up and lifted bravely. He has two children. His daughter, Dara, is seated beside her mother. You will meet his son, Dr. Leopoldo Pafko, called Lep, later as a witness in the case. Lep and Dara have given Donatella and Kirill 5 grandchildren. Surprisingly, Kirill's grandchildren, too, will figure in the evidence you are going to hear. Of course, most of the proof will concern Kirill's professional life. You will learn that Kirill Pafko is both a medical doctor, an M.D., and a Ph.D. in biochemistry. For 4 decades plus, he has been an esteemed professor at Eastern University's Medical College, here in Kendall County, where he has directed one of the world's foremost cancer research labs. Along the way, he also founded a company, Pafko Therapeutics, which puts his research into practice, producing life-saving cancer medications. I apologize now, because in this case you will hear a good deal about cancer. As we learned during voir dire, Stern says, using the term for the judge's questioning of prospective jurors, many of us have our own sad experience with cancer, through the suffering of a loved one, or even... Stern meaningfully touches the lapel on his suit jacket. Ourselves. If the fight against cancer may be likened to a worldwide war, then Kirill Pafko has been one of the human race's leading generals, and, as the evidence will show you, one of that war's most decorated heroes. Using his ivory-knobbed walking stick, Stern steps closer to the jurors. Despite a light remark or two from me, Stern says, I am sure you understand that for Dr. Pafko, this case is not a laughing matter. You have heard an excellent opening statement from my friend, Moses Appleton. Stern gestures to the crowded prosecution table beside him, where Moses, a square man in a store-bought suit, screws up his lips and his narrow, faint mustache in suspicion. He clearly regards Stern's compliment as tactical, as it is, but also sincere. After trying half a dozen cases against Moses over the years, Stern knows that the U.S. attorney's stolid, plain-spoken way strikes all but the most blatantly racist jurors as reliable. Mr. Appleton has summarized the evidence, as the government would have you see it. For nearly a decade, he says, Pafko Therapeutics, sometimes called PT,
worked on a cancer wonder drug called G-Livia. That much is true. What is untrue is Mr. Appleton's claim that the medication received rapid approval from the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, only because Dr. Pafko falsified the clinical trial data for G-Livia to conceal a series of unexpected deaths. You will learn that Kirill Pafko did nothing like that. But Mr. Appleton maintains that this imagined fraud caused Dr. Pafko's stock in PT to gain several hundred million dollars in value, even while seven cancer patients named in the indictment had their lives cut short. In consequence, the prosecutors have charged this 78-year-old scientist, revered around the globe, as if he were a mafia don. In count one of the indictment, the government has alleged a strange crime called racketeering that combines a grab bag of state and federal offenses. Kirill Pafko is now accused of fraud by several different names, of insider stock trading, and if all that were not enough, of murder. Murder, Stern repeats, and goes completely still for a second. Not a laughing matter at all. Pausing for effect, Stern glances to Marta to gauge how he is doing. If the Sterns had followed their long custom, Marta would be addressing the jury in opening. But she has gallantly given way to her father, saying he is entitled to maximum time at center stage for his final bow. The truth, Stern suspects, is that she does not care much for their client, and regards the case as her father's last folly, a misjudgment of age or vanity or both, and besides all that, a test Stern may no longer be up to. Marta would say this case has nearly killed Stern once already. 8 months ago, in March, he was sideswiped at high speed on the interstate as he was driving back from witness interviews at PT. Stern's Cadillac was slammed into a ditch, while Stern himself was unconscious when the ambulance arrived at the hospital, where a subdural hematoma, blood on the brain, required immediate neurosurgery. He was confused for days, but by now the neurologist says his scans are normal for a person of 85. The qualification troubles Marta, but Kirill, who after all has a medical education, continues to insist his old friend represent him. In the courtroom, Stern has always been his best self. Yet he also knows that here, the truth emerges through a fierce struggle between the sides that will push him to his very limits. But for 49 years, Stern has approached every case almost as if he, as much as his client, were on trial. Each day consumes his entire spirit. He will sleep fitfully as the witnesses take over his dreams. The worst moment, as always, came this morning, the first day of the actual trial, always like a play's opening night. Anxiety was a rodent gnawing on his heart, and the office was in bedlam. Pinky, his granddaughter, was ranting about misfires with the computer slides for Stern's opening. Marta was dashing to and from the conference room, issuing last-minute directions for legal research to four young lawyers on loan to Stern and Stern. Vondra, Stern's assistant, kept invading his office to check his trial bag, while in the hallways it looked as if the entire support staff was building the pyramids, loading a long hand cart with the huge transfer cases of documents and office equipment that would be needed in the courtroom. In his few instants alone, Stern focused on his opening, trying to etch it into memory, an effort cut short when Kirill and Donatella arrived for a final briefing, during which Stern was required to project an air of utter calm. And yet this is the life he has been reluctant to forsake. It is not ego or money, the tabloid version of his motives, that have kept him working. The reasons are more personal and complex. For whatever the frequent frustrations of practicing law, the plain truth is that Mr. Alejandro Stern has adored it. The rushing about, the telephone calls, the small breaks of light in the tangle of egos and rules. His clients! For him, no siren song could be more enticing than an anguished call from someone in dire straits. In his early years, a hooligan in the precinct lockup, or, as happens more typically these days, a business person with a federal agent at the door. He has always answered with the majestic calm of a superhero. "Speak to no one. I shall be there momentarily." What was it? What was this mad devotion to people who were often scoundrels, hoping to avoid a punishment that even Stern knew they deserved, who balked at paying fees, who lied to him routinely, and who scorned him the moment a case was lost? They needed him. Needed him. These weak, injured, even buffoonish characters required the assistance of Mr. Alejandro Stern to make their way. Their lives teetered on the cliff edge of destruction. They wept in his office and swore to murder their turncoat comrades. When sanity returned, they dried their eyes and waited, pathetically, for Stern to tell them what to do. "Now," he would say quietly, "the work of 6 decades, reduced to a few words." If some of the central figures in his life, his first wife, Clara, the mother of his children, who died a suicide in 1989, or Peter, his eldest child, or in rare moods, Helen, who left Stern a widower again 2 years ago, if they were present to hear Stern sing lyrics about his clients, his family would ask pointedly, "And what about us?" To their implicit accusation, Stern, ironically, has no defense. The brute fact is that his energies and attention have often been entirely consumed by the courtroom, leaving less than he would have liked for the people he claims to love. All he can offer in response is candor. "This is the life I needed to live." At 85, he is certain that without it, he never would have known himself. 2. The Witnesses. Timeline of critical events. 12/9/14. FDA designates G. Livia as breakthrough therapy. 4/1/15. 18-month clinical trial of G. Livia begins. 9/15/16. Kirill Pavko learns of sudden deaths of clinical trial patients on G. Livia. Trial database altered to omit deaths. 10/27/16. PT submits altered database to FDA for G. Livia approval. 1/16/17. G. Livia approved for sale by FDA. 8/7/18. K. Pavko tells reporter he's never heard of sudden deaths of G. Livia patients. Sells $20 million worth of PT stock. 12/12/18. Kirill Pavko indicted. In his opening, Moses was himself, methodical but brief. His great gift with juries is sticking to essentials, and he did a good job explaining a somewhat complicated case, illuminating his timeline on a 60-inch monitor wheeled in front of the witness stand. Moses' account started in 2014, when Pavko Therapeutics presented the FDA with early test results for G. Livia. Patients with non-small cell lung cancer who'd received the medication, even for a few months, showed dramatic improvements compared to those on the current standard therapies. The disease spread more slowly, and in many cases, tumors had actually receded. The FDA granted G. Livia breakthrough therapy designation, which could speed the testing and approval process. In consultation with agency experts, PT planned an 18-month clinical trial of G-Livia. Assuming the product again showed the same clear benefits and extended lives, the medication would proceed to final FDA approval and become available for prescription years earlier than normal. Days away from the completion of that trial in September 2016, troubling reports reached Kirill through his son, Lep, PT's medical director. Starting in the 13th month of the test, roughly a dozen patients at clinical sites around the world had died suddenly for unaccountable reasons that seemed to have no connection to their cancer. Instead of leaving the matter to a panel of outside experts who, by protocol, were supposed to investigate such reports, Kirill looked into the issue on his own. According to Lep, Kirill told him he had consulted the company in Taiwan administering the trial, which quickly realized that there had been no sudden deaths. A simple coding error had mislabeled patients who had withdrawn from the study, as patients always do, as fatalities. The database was changed, corrected, Kirill might say, and soon after submitted to the FDA. In January 2017, the FDA approved G-Livia for sale to the public. PT's share price skyrocketed, especially after a bidding war erupted between two large pharma companies to buy the concern. But in August 2018, before the acquisition by Tolliver, the winner, was completed, a reporter from the Wall Street Journal phoned Kirill, seeking comment on a pending story. The Journal was about to publish an investigative piece stating that after more than a year on G-Livia, isolated cancer patients were dying suddenly of a suspected allergic reaction. Kirill told the reporter he knew nothing about any sudden deaths, but moments after he put down the phone, he secretly ordered the sale of roughly $20 million worth of PT stock. Once the Journal story appeared, the value of PAFCO Therapeutics shares plummeted, crashing almost completely several weeks later, when the FDA publicly questioned the clinical trial data for G-Livia. Kirill PAFCO's indictment by a federal grand jury in Kendall County followed soon after. In presenting the summary, Moses has used only 40 of the 50 minutes Judge Klonsky has allotted to each side for opening statements. His brevity is meant to signal to the jurors that despite the foreign world of drug testing, the crime is clear. But the U.S. attorney's simplifications create some opportunities for the defense. Stern asks Moses to bring the timeline back up on the monitor, a request the prosecutor may not refuse, but which causes obvious consternation at the prosecution table, where 9 investigators and lawyers are seated. Aside from Moses, the only other person there who will address the jury is a lean young assistant U.S. attorney with a glossy mop of black hair named Daniel Feld, presently typing on his laptop with the passion of a concert pianist. "As always," Stern says now to the jury, after elaborating on Kirill's presumption of innocence and the government's heavy burden of proof, "there are 2 sides to this story and some vital facts Mr. Appleton chose not to mention to you. At the very heart of the charges that the government must prove, beyond a reasonable doubt." Stern, as ever, speaks the last 4 words with slow weight. "Is their claim that Kirill PAFCO is responsible for altering the results of the clinical trial of G-Livia in September 2016, erasing evidence of a dozen sudden, baffling deaths. Despite all the fanfare, testimony from Dr. Pavko's colleagues, forensic analysis of Kirill's office computer, records of his phone calls, after all of that, you will learn that..." Stern pauses before again laying emphasis on the next words. "Dr. Kirill PAFCO altered nothing. not in September 2016 or any other time. Nothing. With that, Stern nods to Pinky, who is triggering her laptop to display slides on the giant monitor, emphasizing Stern's principal points. The timeline fades out, and the phrase, "Kirill altered nothing," appears on screen. Pinky, who is also at times her grandfather's roommate, is a frequently infuriating employee. Marta would have fired her sister's daughter long ago, but Stern continues to hold out hope. Still, he could not contain a swell of relief that Pinky actually showed up at work this morning, or again now, when it appears she's kept the slides in the correct order. "But didn't Mr. Appleton say the results were altered?" "Yes, but not by Kirill. The changes were made in Taiwan by Dr. Wendy Ho, who works for the company that was conducting these trials for PT. You will see Dr. Ho as a witness, and you will have an opportunity to listen to her. The evidence will show you that her reasons for altering this database were not as the government describes. In point of fact, you will see that the motives the government imagines are often just that, imaginary. For example, Mr. Appleton suggested that Dr. Pafko committed this fraud in order to become a mega-millionaire. Yes, the value of PT's stock rose steeply once G-Livia was approved by the FDA. G-Livia is a remarkable medication, and it was no surprise that big pharma companies immediately wanted to buy PT. But since G-Livia was first given breakthrough therapy designation, from that day until today, Kirill Pafko has not grown a penny richer personally by selling PT stock. Mr. Appleton did not think it was important to tell you that. Pinky reveals a note on the screen reiterating that Kirill made no money, while Stern, accompanied by the solid thump of his cane, again moves toward the jurors, pleased that he seems to have their attention. They are the face of America, all colors, half from the suburbs, seven from Kendall County, their ages ranging from lively-looking Mrs. Murtaugh, a widow of 82, to Don Something, a hip young guy with a ponytail who wants to teach high school. He is already keeping a close eye on Pinky, whom people her age seem to regard as attractive, despite what her grandfather sees as bizarre affectations, like the day-glow tattoos frescoed on her arms or the nail through her nose. "But didn't Mr. Appleton say that Dr. Pafko was charged with securities fraud for insider trading? That he sold PT stock right after he received the first call from that Wall Street Journal reporter?" "Yes. But I am not sure you would understand from Mr. Appleton's summary that the stock that was sold was in trust for Dr. Pafko's grandchildren." Stern utters this word triumphantly, even though he is well aware that under the insider trading laws, the fact that Kirill's grandchildren profited rather than Kirill himself is inconsequential. The jurors will not learn that for weeks until Judge Klonsky gives them instructions on the law, and at the moment, Marta and Stern are unsure what else they can offer in defense of these charges. Now, the point I have just illustrated, that the evidence will show another side to things, is something you must bear in mind throughout. While the government is trying to prove its case, it will decide on the witnesses and ask those persons questions first. Then Marta and I get to ask questions, a process referred to as cross-examination. Please, in all instances, be sure to await our inquiries before attempting to form impressions. It will often turn out that some, even much, of the testimony of a witness called by the government actually favors the defense. Second, in every case, just as if these witnesses were salespeople who knocked on your door at home, you must ask yourself if this person has something to gain by what they are saying. For instance, at least two of them, both former colleagues of Dr. Pavko's at PT, have been promised by the government that they will not be prosecuted for their role in the events they are testifying about. You will learn that it is the government, and the government alone, not the judge, not you, not me, that has the power to decide whether a person is charged with a crime. Thus, the proof will show quite plainly that these former colleagues of Dr. Pavko's understand their testimony must satisfy the prosecutors. Oddly, even though these two executives from PT refused to testify without the government promising not to charge them, both will tell you that so far as they are concerned, they did nothing wrong. Kirill, of course, agrees. He, too, believes that no crime was committed in this case, no intentional fraud, not by him or anyone else. Particularly because, as you will see, one of these two non-prosecution witnesses is Kirill's and Donatella's older child, their son, Lep. Lep is an MD and PhD like his father, as well as the medical director at PT. Now, it is a very strange, very difficult situation when a son testifies against his father. The evidence will show you, however, that Lep loves his father and his father loves Lep. Both understand that this is a circumstance the government has forced upon them.
Objection, says Moses for the first time from his seat. Sunny reflects a second, then shakes her head. Overruled. Stern takes a second to offer the jury a smile of calm vindication. Now, aside from Lep, the second of these non-prosecution witnesses is another very accomplished person with an M.D. and Ph.D., Dr. Innes McVie. Dr. McVie is the former executive vice president and chief operating officer at PT, who, along with Lep and Kirill, helped found Pavko Therapeutics. She worked beside Dr. Pavko for 32 years, first as a researcher in his lab at Easton, and later as second in charge at the company. Once G. Livia was approved for sale in January 2017, she left PT. As happens after decades side by side, disagreements had developed between Dr. Pavko and her, although the details need not concern us. Stern offers a little wave at the superfluous. What the jury will not hear, as a result of a defense motion Judge Klonsky ruled on in private in her chambers before the trial started, is that for most of Innes's 32 years with Kirill, she was his lover, his wife at work, as some called her, a fact Stern himself learned only after trial preparations were underway. Innes, apparently, spent her last 20 months at PT in a state of fury, after Pavko began carrying on with a far younger officer, the marketing director, Olga Fernandez. At any rate, Drs. McVie and Pavko were no longer on good terms, which will be quite apparent to you because in August 2018, after Dr. Pavko received this call from the Wall Street Journal reporter, Kirill phoned Dr. McVie for advice. And strangely, she decided to record their conversation. Mr. Appleton has said you will hear that recording. If Mr. Appleton changes his mind, have no fear. The defense will play it for you. One thing you will learn is that it was Dr. McVie, not Dr. Pavko, who first suggested that he sell PT stock. And yet, the government decided not to prosecute her. Stern wrinkles his mouth and narrows his eyes to suggest the government's decision is imponderable, disturbing. So, you understand my point. As you hear the witnesses, ask yourself, please, what stake this person may have in saying what they do? Another example. You will be hearing from agents and officials of the FDA and FBI. Remember, they are quite literally testifying for their boss, the government of the United States, which is also prosecuting Kirill. Each, I suspect, would say they want to keep their jobs. Some testimony, like that from investment bankers and stockbrokers, will come from people who might have a financial interest in what they are saying. You also will learn that a number of civil lawsuits have been filed seeking money damages from Kirill and PT for the same events addressed in the indictment. It will turn out that some witnesses, here to testify about the heartbreaking deaths of their loved ones, are seeking, and sometimes have been paid, millions and millions of dollars by PT in these civil cases. Objection! Across the courtroom, Moses has rocketed to his feet, thundering the word. A second of stillness follows, since it is evident in Moses' bearing that he is a man seldom provoked to fury. Your Honor, he says, we have discussed this subject, and the court's ruling was crystal clear. Staring down grimly at Stern, Judge Klonsky answers, indeed it was. The objection is sustained. The jury will disregard Mr. Stern's last statement. For another second, the show of anger from the U.S. attorney and the judge continues to trouble the atmosphere of the huge courtroom, where every seat is filled. In fact, Judge Klonsky says, remembering the outline of your remarks, Mr. Stern, I think it's a good time for a break. Let's take 10 minutes. Sonny then tells the jury that until the end of the case, they should not talk among themselves about what they have heard in the courtroom. With that, she motions to the deputy marshal to escort them through a back door to the jury room, where they will gather every day and eventually deliberate. As the jurors exit, the lawyers come to their feet, while the judge, still clearly vexed, orders the attorneys to meet with her in chambers. In the meantime, as Marta stands at Stern's shoulder, his daughter whispers, "What the hell was that?" 3. Friends. A judge's chambers are her private offices. Sonny's, the impressive space afforded the chief judge of the United States District Court, consists of several rooms that occupy nearly a quarter of the top floor of the grand old federal courthouse. Beside the reception area, three small offices house the law clerks, who help the judge write her opinions, and the docket clerk, Luis, who manages the 450 or so civil and criminal cases over which the judge presides. The remaining area is reserved for the chief judge herself. A huge old Federalist desk is by the windows. Shelves of law books with golden bindings, little more than decorations in the computer era, ring the perimeter. And there is a long, dark conference table surrounded by leather executive chairs where the judge holds her meetings. Prominent on the walls are family photos of Sonny's grandchildren and a few courtroom sketches from her earlier career, including one in which Sonny, then an assistant United States attorney, is portrayed before the jury box, a finger poised. In the background of the watercolor is her trial partner in that case, Moses Appleton, recognizable, like the judge, in leaner, younger days. Meetings in chambers can be conducted outside the presence of the jury and the press. Nonetheless, Minnie Aleo, Sonny's court reporter, has taken a place in the corner with her steno machine that transforms shorthand into a transcript. As Moses edges past Stern to find a place on the other side of the conference table, the United States attorney, still provoked by what has just gone on in court, whispers, "Man, I didn't think we were going to try this case that way." Moses has always treated the Stearns as a cut above, a better class of defense counsel who, unlike many, eschew underhandedness as a defendant's right, and Stern registers Moses' rebuke as troubling. The judge, who has not bothered to remove her robe, as she ordinarily does in chambers, has chosen to stand at the end of the table while the lawyers sit, re-emphasizing her authority. "I decided it's a good moment to have a word with the group. We all know that my long relationships with the lawyers in this case are somewhat unusual. We are all friends here, and we will be friends when this case is over. But I will not allow any of you to impose on my friendship while this case is on trial." With those words, Sonny levels her dark eyes at Stern. "We had extended discussions last week about how to deal with the delicate matter of the many civil lawsuits that are pending against P.T. and Dr. Pafko." Kirill's indictment provided a vulture's meal to the plaintiff's bar. 2 days after the first journal article, the Newcrest law firm here in Kendall County had worked its customary magic and had filed multi-million-dollar suits for wrongful death in behalf of 5 families from across the U.S., quickly followed by dozens more civil cases brought by the Newcrests and other personal injury lawyers from coast to coast. Besides those suits, several plaintiffs' class actions have been filed in behalf of P.T.'s shareholders, alleging securities law violations and damages of hundreds of millions of dollars. The distinction between civil cases brought by private citizens to seek financial compensation for their injuries and criminal cases initiated by the government with the usual goal of sending the defendant to prison often confuses laypeople. That could be expected to include jurors who might not understand that in order to convict someone for a crime, the evidence must leave them far more certain, no reasonable doubts about guilt, than in a civil case. For that reason, Sonny was initially inclined to forbid any mention of the civil suits. But during last week's pre-trial rulings, she accepted the Stern's arguments that fairness requires allowing the jury to know that some witnesses stand to profit by their testimony. Even so, the judge said that she would decide what questions were proper, one witness at a time. "Giving the benefit of the doubt," Sonny says now as she stands over the table, directing a hard look at Stern, "I suppose I can see, Sandy, how you misinterpreted my ruling and thought it was all right to mention the civil cases briefly. But I was clear as day that there was to be no mention of the money any witness was seeking or had been paid. In fact, Sandy," Sonny says, "I have a distinct memory of you saying that the jury might take actual settlements as an admission of guilt on Dr. Pafko's part. Am I wrong about that?" Stern hesitates briefly, just to give appropriate recognition to the judge's ire. "You surely are not, Your Honor, but I found in the moment that I had changed my mind." In the courtroom, facing the actual jurors and the prospect of the heart-sore testimony of persons whose loved one died after taking G. Livia, it was suddenly clear to Stern that Kirill was better off if the jury realized that they did not have to convict Pafko to ensure the grieving families received some compensation. He can see, however, from what swims across the judge's face, that this explanation startles her, and she straightens up. "Yes, Sandy, but I did not change mine." With the words, she sets her knuckles on the table, robe billowing, bringing the level of her dark eyes closer to Stern's. "If you or any other lawyer disobey my rulings again, then, old friend or not, I will deal with you appropriately." The omen is absorbed in silence. The chief judge's long friendship with each of the lawyers in the case is an awkward fact. Stern and she met 3 decades ago, when Sonny was an assistant U.S. attorney investigating Stern's client, his sister's husband. It was a difficult time for both of them. Stern was only weeks past Clara's suicide, and Sonny's marriage was collapsing while she was in the late stage of pregnancy. With both lawyers at sea emotionally, there was a dizzy night when they seemed smitten with each other. The infatuation dissolved in the daylight like a dream, entirely unrealized. Now Stern's body is in decay, and while Sonny's robust beauty remains, she has become completely gray and rounder. Yet in Stern's view, the importance of those kinds of attachments in a life never fully fades. Marta has a more current bond with the judge. She shared a nanny, Everarda, with Sonny for years. They refer to one another as besties. Work, by long-standing agreement, is never part of their conversations, which reinforces their intimacy, since they speak routinely of husbands, children, the travails of family, what is closest to their hearts. Because of both Stern's affinities with the judge, in Sonny's 25 years on the bench in state, then federal court, neither Sandy nor Marta has ever tried a case before her. It was Moses's ascension to U.S. attorney that complicated matters. As the drawing on Sonny's wall reflects, Appleton and she were prosecutors together, favored trial partners who forged the bonds of battle. Sonny and her husband, Michael, are probably the best friends Moses and his wife, Sharon, have away from River of Zion Baptist Church, where Moses frequently preaches. When their daughter, Deborah, finished law school, she served for 2 years as Sonny's law clerk, overlapping for a year with her co-clerk, Dan Feld. Furthermore, Sonny cannot simply remove herself from Moses's cases. The U.S. attorney is the government's sole official representative in federal district court, meaning that almost 70% of Sonny's trial docket is consumed by criminal and, sometimes, civil matters brought in Moses's name. His reputation is at stake in every one of those cases, whether or not he is present in court. Recusal would require Sonny to stop doing the bulk of her job. Worse, it would burden her fellow judges, who would inherit those cases, an especially unbecoming development, inasmuch as the chief judge must prod the other district judges to stay up to date with their caseloads. Accordingly, when the case was randomly assigned to Judge Klonsky, she sent a joint email to Moses and Stern and Marta. Talk among yourselves and in your offices. If you think, on balance, you want a different judge, just email Luis, her docket clerk, and tell him to put it back on the wheel. No hard feelings, I promise. Moses was the first to hit reply all and say, no objections here. Marta was less inclined to agree, but Stern pointed out that Kirill's interests favored staying put. Sonny is an excellent trial judge who is fairer to the defense than many of the former prosecutors on the bench, and she is also a lighter touch at sentencing. Now they are at the first crossroads. Facing Sonny's baleful look, Stern can only speak the truth.
Your Honor, I was confused, he says.
The words are sincere, but the explanation settles in the room like a bad odor. It is a second before Stern recognizes that what he said might be taken as a reference to his age. The judge jolts slightly, while Stern continues to fumble.
I thought that because Your Honor had ruled in response to our objection, we could proceed otherwise.
This explanation does not really make sense even to him, and in the end, he can only offer abject apologies and a promise that there will be no reoccurrence.